اتفاق افتاد و وقتی که به قضایای سالهای 56 و اینا رسیدن.
Anyway, as they faced the events in 1977 and 1978, they found out that they couldn't do anything because they had done anything possible without being successful. They agreed to have an open political space since the US had asked them. They were to hold a free election and form a national government, but in reality, from early 1979, they lost control and could do nothing, although Jimmy Carter called the Shah several times, allowing him to do anything to control the situation, and assured the Shah of his support. In other words, Carter said what Cyrus Vance had said before. The US didn't want the Shah to fall, but to improve the situation a little bit.
These changes improved the situation for political prisoners, and old lags on small charges were released.
Since SAVAK had lost its support, it was forced to release many prisoners, those who had finished their terms and those who were in prison for very simple unarmed activities.
On October the 24th, 1978, 1,126 political prisoners were released. Among them was Safar Qahramani, one who had been in different prisons for about 30 years. By releasing these prisoners, most of them on minor charges like reading forbidden books, the regime wanted to control public indignation. The newly released prisoners went to Behesht-e Zahra Cemetery to pay homage to those who lost their lives fighting for freedom. They said they owed their freedom to public support, not to the false benevolence of the regime. In January 1979, the Shah left Iran under the pretext of receiving medical treatment. Weeks later, Imam Khomeini returned to Iran after 15 years of exile. His arrival gave the nation a new lease of life. Within a short space of time, the people took control of all military and strategic centers, including the Qasr prison, and released all political prisoners. A number of army top brass and SAVAK agents were arrested and put in the prison for a while. The first trials to investigate their crimes were held in the mosque of this prison. After the 1979 revolution, the Qasr prison was converted into an ordinary prison. But since it was located inside the residential district, in 2001 it was closed down forever. The municipality of Tehran then reconstructed the building and turned it into a museum. A museum that embodies the 200-year history of modern Iran.
During the time I was in the political department of the Garda Museum, I saw the youth we talked to change their opinions completely at the end of their visit. They couldn't believe that in Iran, under the Shah, such things existed. The society must be informed about it. The world must be informed about it.
For me, these things must be etched on the walls of the Qasr prison. Here is the mirror reflecting the downfall of cruelty and corruption.
The Qasr Garden Museum in the heart of Tehran, a place that would once send shivers up and down spines, has now become a favorite haunt for people.
Most of the visitors who come here have a critical attitude. But when they're leaving here, they are overwhelmed and express their kindness to us. When it's explained for them, they realize what had happened here and who had to bear what harms and sufferings.
With its many programs and shows, the museum magnetizes a variety of visitors from friends and families to school students and tourists.
In my opinion, the Qasr Garden Museum is a national place. and its programs must be national and distinguished, and even have a look at international programs. I believe that these bricks in this space are alive with the breaths of people. They must come and go if we want this place to be alive. When you enter Ras Garden Museum, we see a pleasant place. That's due to the breaths of families who come here willingly.
A palace, a prison, and now a museum. A witness to the pain and grief of many people, this edifice has many stories to tell the children of this ancient land.
Well, with the drastic changes the edifice witnessed in the past 200 years, one can only wonder what will become of it 200 years from now. And that's it for this week's episode. Thank you for your time and attention. Until next week and another Aperture, goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
It can't be emphasized enough just how many taxpayer dollars are now being showered on the Pentagon, says William Harting, journalist, in an article titled $778 billion and counting. Who is paying for all this Pentagon waste? Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. '21 was another banner year for the military-industrial complex as U.S. Congress signed off on a new record $778 billion in spending for the Pentagon and related work on nuclear warheads at the Department of Energy. That was $25 billion more than the Pentagon had even asked for. It can't be emphasized enough just how many taxpayer dollars are now being showered on the Pentagon. That department's astronomical budget adds up, for instance, to more than four times the cost of the most recent version of Biden's Build Back Better plan, which sparked such horrified opposition from Senator Joe Manchin and other alleged fiscal conservatives. Naturally, they didn't blink when it came to lavishing ever more taxpayer dollars on the military-industrial complex. Opposing Build Back Better while throwing so much more money at the Pentagon marks the ultimate in budgetary and national security hypocrisy. Congressional Budget Office has determined that if current trends continue, the Pentagon could receive a monumental $7.3 trillion plus over the next decade, more than was spent during the peak decade of the Afghan and Iraq wars, when there were up to 190,000 American troops in those countries alone. Sadly, all too periodically, Biden's decision to withdraw U.S. troops and contractors from Afghanistan hasn't generated even the slightest peace dividend. Instead, any savings from that war are already being plowed into programs to counter China, official Washington's budget-justifying threat of choice. And all of this despite the fact that the United States already spends three times as much as China on its military. The Pentagon budget is not only gargantuan, but replete with waste, from vast overcharges for spare parts to weapons that don't work at unaffordable prices to forever wars with immense human and economic consequences. Simply put, the current level of Pentagon spending is both unnecessary and irrational. Overcharging the Pentagon for spare parts has a long and inglorious history, reaching its previous peak of public visibility during the presidency of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. Then, blanket media coverage of $640 toilet seats and $7,600 coffee makers sparked public outrage and a series of hearings on Capitol Hill, strengthening the backbone of members of Congress. In those years, they did indeed curb at least the worst excesses of the Reagan military build-up. Such pricing horror stories didn't emerge from thin air. They came from the work of people like legendary Pentagon whistleblower Ernest Fitzgerald. He initially made his mark by exposing the Air Force's efforts to hide billions in cost overruns on Lockheed's massive C-5A transport plane. At the time, he was described by former Air Force Secretary Warren Orr as the most hated man in the Air Force. Fitzgerald and other Pentagon insiders became sources for Dina Razor, a young journalist who began drawing the attention of the media and congressional representatives to spare parts overcharges and other military horrors. In the end, she formed an organization, the Project on Military Procurement, to investigate and expose waste, fraud, and abuse. It would later evolve into the Project on Government Oversight, or POGO, the most effective current watchdog when it comes to Pentagon spending. A recent POGO analysis, for instance, documented the malfeasance of TransDigm, a military parts supplier that the Department of Defense's Inspector General caught overcharging the Pentagon by as much as 3,800%, yes, you read that figure right, on routine items. The company was able to do so only because, bizarrely enough, Pentagon buying rules prevent contract officers from getting accurate information on what any given item should cost or might cost the supplying company to produce it. The next level of Pentagon waste involves weapons they don't need at prices they can't afford. Systems that, for staggering sums, fail to deliver on promises to enhance the safety and security of Americans. The poster child for such costly, dysfunctional systems is F-35 combat aircraft, a plane tasked with multiple missions, none of which it does well. The Pentagon is slated to buy more than 2,400 F-35s for the Air Force, Marines, and Navy. The estimated lifetime cost for procuring and operating those planes, a mere $1.7 trillion, would make it the Pentagon's most expensive weapons project ever. Once upon a time, as in some fairy tale, the idea behind the creation of F-35 was to build a plane that, in several variations, would be able to carry out many different tasks relatively cheaply, with potential savings generated by economies of scale. Theoretically, that meant the bulk of the parts for the thousands of planes to be built would be the same for all of them. This approach has proven a dismal failure so far, so much so that the researchers at POGO are convinced that the F-35 may never be fully ready for combat. And its failures are too numerous to recount here. But a few examples should suffice to suggest why the program minimally needs to be scaled back in a major way, if not canceled completely. For a start, though meant to provide air support for troops on the ground, is proved anything but well designed to do so. In fact, that job is already handled far better and more cheaply by existing A-10 Warthog attack aircraft. A 2021 Pentagon assessment of the F-35, and keep in mind that this is the Department of Defense, not the same outside expert, found 800 unresolved defects in the plane. Typical of its never-ending problems, a widely expensive and not particularly functional high-tech helmet, which at a cost of $400,000 each, is meant to give its pilot a special awareness of what's happening around and below the plane as well as to the horizon. And don't forget that the F-35 will be staggeringly expensive to maintain and already cost an impressive $38,000 an hour to fly.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Israel is widely viewed as a destabilizing force in the West Asia region. It has started many wars over the past decades against regional nations. The occupying regime's hostile actions are unending. Right now, it is enforcing its expansionist policies in occupied Palestinian territories by building on lands that the international community insists must be given back to the Palestinians. The regime has gained notoriety for committing crimes of apartheid against the Palestinian people on a very large scale. Parts of Syrian and Lebanese territories are also occupied by Israel. The regime routinely carries out airstrikes against Syrian army positions. Among other destabilizing Israeli actions in the region are high-profile assassinations of top nuclear scientists in Iran and sabotage operations against Iranian nuclear energy facilities. The lists of Israel's destabilizing activities and crimes seem endless. Despite the regime's record, some regional states have been getting close to it. The United Arab Emirates seems to be leading the way. The UAE normalized ties with Israel in September 2020 as part of a U.S.-backed initiative that also includes Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. Days ago, Israeli President Isaac Herzog made his first visit to the UAE more than a month after Naftali Bennett became the first Israeli prime minister to visit the country. The president of the regime, widely blamed for regional insecurity in the most volatile part of the world, said ironically that Israel supports the Emirates' security needs.
So it's like bringing the fox in to protect the chicken house. That's not going to work. You let them in, they take over. If you want a good example, look at what happened to the Catholic Church when they signed an agreement with Israel. Israel got everything it wanted, and they never fulfilled one of the obligations that they said they would fulfill. And the situation for Christians in Israel is worse now than before they signed that agreement.
During his visit to the UAE, Herzog discussed security and bilateral ties with Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. Sheikh Mohammed said Israel and the UAE share a, quote, common view of the threats to regional stability and peace. Israel is notorious for creating insecurity in the West Asia region. Why are some Arab countries getting close to the regime and claim they want to enhance security? A few days after Herzog's visit, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian issued a stark warning about the Israeli regime's presence in the region. In a phone call with Emirati Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation, Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, Amir Abdullahian described Israel as a quote-unquote threat to all regional countries, urging efforts to prevent those who create tensions from gaining a foothold there. What would be the consequence of the Israeli regime gaining a stronger foothold in the region? Palestinian resistance group Hamas has also reacted to Herzog's visit. It said such visits encourage the occupation to continue escalating its aggression against the Palestinian people and denial of their rights. The Palestinians, who already face an uphill battle against the occupation, have described the normalization as a stab in the back. The equation in the region has become increasingly complex, keeping observers guessing how it will evolve.
For centuries, Iran was governed by monarchies and autocratic rulers, and the last dynasty to rule was founded by Reza Shah Pahlavi in 1925. During his reign that lasted for 16 years, Reza Shah replaced Islamic laws with Western ones as part of reforms that drew public discontent. In 1941, he was forced to abdicate the throne to his son, Mohammad Reza. The new Shah maintained a close relationship with the U.S. His government was known for its autocracy and focus on westernization, as well as a disregard for religious and democratic measures in Iran's constitution. Mohammad Reza Shah was largely criticized for political corruption and the oppression committed by his secret police, known as Savak. He established the service with help from Israel and the CIA. Its main aim, to monitor opponents and repress dissent. Savak's practice of torture and executions of the regime's opponents made it the most notorious and feared institution in Iran prior to the Islamic Revolution. In 1963, the Shah launched a series of reforms known as the White Revolution. Although the reforms brought some progress to Iran, they were met with a strong criticism from the public. The opposition to Shah and his white revolution was spearheaded by Ayatollah Khomeini, a prominent religious figure who believed the Shah had embarked on a path toward the destruction of Islam. In June of that year, Imam Khomeini delivered his famous sermon at Fazia Seminary, where he strongly criticized the Shah's policies. After that speech, he was arrested, and that sparked 3 days of mass rallies nationwide, with his supporters saying 15,000 people were killed by police. After spending 8 months under house arrest, Imam Khomeini was released. But he remained a strong and outspoken critic of the Shah regime for its policies, including its close cooperation with Israel. In November 1964, Imam Khomeini was rearrested and sent into exile for another 15 years. But popular support for him grew even further during his absence. Opposition to the Pahlavi regime continued to spread, with Iranians outraged at a high inflation rate, a widening gap between rich and poor, and the repression of freedom of speech. Anger was also high at the royal family benefiting the most from the country's oil revenues at a time when thousands of poor people were suffering under austerity measures to curb the inflation. Popular rage was further ignited by the death of Imam Khomeini's son Mustafa at the hands of Savak. His death on October 23, 1977, set off a chain of mass demonstrations that grew in the months ahead and turned into a campaign of civil resistance. To appease the protesters, the Shah regime launched reforms and pledged to do more. However, none of those measures were welcome, with the protesters remaining steadfast as insisting that the monarchy must be overthrown and that Imam Khomeini should return home. The anti-Shah demonstrations started growing in their millions nationwide, despite a heavy-handed crackdown by the military. On January 16, 1979, the Shah and his family finally left Iran for Egypt. And nearly 2 weeks later, on February the 1st, Imam Khomeini returned to Tehran with a promise to form a government that would have popular support. On February the 11th, the Pahlavi regime was overthrown and the Islamic Revolution emerged victorious. And on April the 1st, Iran became an Islamic Republic in a referendum voted for by more than 98% of the electorate. The period from February the 1st to 11th is known as Dahe Fajr, or the 10-day dawn in Iran. Every year, Iranians celebrate the Islamic Revolution that brought an end to 2,500 years of monarchical rule in their country.
A spiritual leader who maintained a simple lifestyle. Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini was born in the city of Khomein on September 24, 1902. He grew up in a family with a long tradition of religious scholarship. He received early Quranic education at home and local schools, and pursued his later studies at Islamic seminaries until he became marja, or a source of emulation, a highly prominent authority in religious law. Imam Khomeini soon rose to fame as an anti-imperialism and anti-colonialism icon. He became politically active when, in 1963, the then US-backed monarch of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, launched a program of reforms known as the White Revolution. The plan was an American-inspired package of measures designed to prop up the regime and nip any voices of dissent in the bud, all in the name of promoting the rights of citizens. Imam Khomeini was the first religious leader who openly condemned the Shah's program of westernization. That opposition led to protests against the monarch. In response, the Pahlavi regime launched a brutal crackdown and arrested Imam Khomeini. His detention resulted in an uprising in June 1963. Demonstrators were confronted by tanks and troops armed to the teeth. Thousands were killed. In November 1964, Imam Khomeini was rearrested and sent into exile. This time because he had opposed the legal immunity the Shah had granted to American military personnel in Iran. He spent over 14 years in exile, mostly in the holy city of Najaf in Iraq. But that didn't stop him from criticizing the Shah for making concessions to Western powers, in his view, a violation of Iranian sovereignty. People from all walks of life listened to his speeches via cassettes and distributed his letters, which became the bedrock of a budding revolution. In the early 1970s, Imam Khomeini gave a series of lectures in Najaf on the establishment of a system based on Islamic values. Those lectures were later published as a book under the title Guardianship of the Islamic Jurists. This was his most famous and influential work. It laid out his ideas on a system of governance that would end dictatorship, establish Sharia or Islam's divine law, and would fight injustice, corruption, and oppression. Imam Khomeini's courage, charisma, and popularity opened a new chapter in a grassroots resistance against the Pahlavi regime. Ultimately, on the 16th of January 1979, the Shah fled Iran, and on February the 1st, Imam Khomeini returned from Nafallah Chateau in France, where he'd been living in exile. 10 days later, Iranians celebrated as the revolution culminated in the overthrow of the US-backed Pahlavi regime. In March 1979, more than 98% of Iranians voted in favor of an Islamic Republic in a referendum. Under such a system proposed by Imam Khomeini, Iran is considered a sovereign country in the form of a republic that implements Islamic laws. A system in marked contrast to the dictatorial Pahlavi regime that was totally dependent on the West, in particular the United States.
Back in 2013, when AFRICOM was first established, only two African countries showed their willingness to host American bases. But now, even South Africa, which once led a campaign against American intervention on the continent, has hosted drills with the US. But that's a cause of concern, particularly considering the spike in coup attempts in West and East Africa, areas that host the largest concentration of US bases. At least 7 coups over the past 13 years have reportedly involved troops trained under AFRICOM. Last week, a Pentagon report suggested a 70% annual increase in violent events linked to militant groups in the Sahel region. According to the data, last year, attacks across the region jumped from 1,180 to at least 2,005, the most dramatic hike on the continent. Those attacks have killed an estimated 4,800 people last year, accounting for some two-thirds of the total number of terror attack victims in Africa.
Well, I think the U.S. is very much afraid of Africa becoming, the countries of Africa working together and becoming a powerhouse that would be able to rival the United States and rival Western Europe. Because you have to think about it, Africa is a very, very big continent, which much bigger than the United States, with a lot more valuable resources in this modern age. So I think the United States is afraid.
The U.S. maintains its military presence in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but human rights groups say civilians have been caught in the crossfire and casualties from U.S. airstrikes are higher than have been reported. The United States' increased foothold in Africa has raised concerns, as the country hasn't had a good track record even when it comes to delivering on its stated claims of fighting terrorism. Take Somalia, for example, where the U.S. has been conducting airstrikes against Al-Shabaab terrorists for a decade. Despite the U.S. attacks, Al-Shabaab has proven resilient and is still able to carry out high-profile attacks in the country and neighboring states such as Kenya. In addition, rights groups have long accused AFRICOM of shrouding its operations in secrecy and denying accountability for the civilians killed in its airstrikes. The United States has failed to provide an accurate tally of equipment and resources it has sent to U.S. Africa Command partner nations in its most recent audit. That has raised concerns that the equipment might have fallen to the wrong hands.
So the United States, by picking up this banner that the United Kingdom, the British Empire left, has basically realized the most effective way to combat any sort of rise of anti-imperialism or any sort of self-determination for these colonized, these exploited countries, is by, instead of just launching a full-out invasion of U.S. forces, that the intelligence agencies should begin covertly funding and fostering organizations that will have inner conflict between the main group, the in the case of Mau Mau, by supporting a counter game.
What the U.S. needs to keep in mind when making decisions about investing militarily in Africa is the outcome of its 20-year-long war in Afghanistan, as all the American lives lost and all the funds spent there turn out to be for nothing.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
January 5th, 2022.
The January 9th uprising was a brilliant combination of zeal and rationality. The refusal to surrender to an arrogant enemy is another principle of the revolution. One should not tolerate the enemy's aggression. It is one thing to negotiate, for example, with the enemy, but it is quite another thing to interact and cooperate with them. The revolution says that we should not surrender to the aggression and unreasonable demands of the enemy. We have not surrendered up until now, and we will not surrender from now on either. This is one of the principles. But they are attempting to undermine this by saying, what's wrong with that? What's the problem? In other words, they wish to undermine such an outstanding principle. Other principles of the revolution include the independence of the country and fighting corruption, injustice, and the like. These are parts of the vast, diverse, soft war which is pursued by the enemy. We should pay attention to these points and prevent the elimination of this sensitivity. Intellectuals, writers, speakers, those who pursue various social activities, those who are active in the internet, and those who have various capabilities are responsible in this regard.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They should not allow the enemies to gradually undermine the sensitivity and zeal of the people. We must realize that the idea that these principles are not beneficial for the people, for the country, and for the future is a very wrong idea. It is pure injustice. Over the past 43 years in our country, whenever we have made progress, whenever we have made a successful move, and whenever we have had resources at our disposal, it was because we had revolutionary people who entered the field with high morale and diligence, who worked hard. As a result of this, we have made progress. Whenever pious, revolutionary, well-informed, competent individuals entered scientific, industrial, technical, and political areas, we have been able to make progress. And when we look at why a task in hand did not move forward, we see that it was because of opportunism, corruption, and aristocratic non-revolutionary outlooks and moves. These things cause the tasks in hand to not be worked on and to stop moving forward. Therefore, commitment to the principles of the revolution is surely one of the most important means for the progress of the country and the nation. This is another point that you should pay attention to. The next point, which in my opinion is very important, is the issue of preserving unity in the country. We must reduce the factors that create discord as much as we can. Of course, there are differences in opinion, viewpoints, methods, and mentalities. These things exist, but we should not let them lead to taking stances against one another.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Islamic Revolution and Islamic Art. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are in 10 days done, the period marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The art of the Islamic Revolution is a special kind of art which was shaped concurrent with the struggles of nationwide struggles in Iran against the despotic Pahlavi regime. The works of this art have tried to promote the Islamic and revolutionary thoughts more or less for over four decades. Thus, the art of the Islamic Revolution can be called a branch of the Islamic art. The Islamic art emerged in the 6th century AD. Later on, it was manifested in various geographical regions according to the features of those regions. Iran is among the countries in which Islam spread very rapidly. Owing to its cultural and artistic record, this country was effective in bolstering the Islamic culture and art. Yet, it should be mentioned that Islamic art is part and parcel of the Iranian identity, and this religion has been very effective in strengthening the Islamic civilization. Some researchers are of the opinion that the Islamic art is the art of conveying the divine concepts. Therefore, this art should be at the service of the Islamic teachings. In other words, the Islamic art should mirror the metaphysics and the spiritual aspects of life. As it has been several times, and it is quite obvious, the Islamic Revolution was triumphed during the heyday of the anti-religion schools and ideologies like Marxism and liberalism. The Islamic Revolution presented a new message and put forward a new way which showed the bond between human being and religion. Heeding the sublimity of mankind and paving the ground for growth of human merits shaped the main principles of the Islamic constructions. In view of this, the absurd thoughts and models like art for art's sake were pushed to the margin, as the Muslim artist always feels responsible before the people and above all God for what he or she creates. During the first years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, popular art was praised as the substitute for modernist art, which was an amalgamation of realism and expressionism, and ultimately had its roots in humanism and liberalism. Concurrent with distancing from foreign culture, strengthening the domestic one had good impact on Iran's art. Thus, the Iranian art was introduced in global arenas. For instance, the Iranian cinema was introduced with different themes and higher quality and quantity. This cinema was known as across the world as an example of cinema committed to ethics, human values, and the values of the Islam and Islamic Revolution. The Islamic Revolution, like any other social, political, and cultural phenomena, had no choice for production and transmission of its ideals and values but to manifest them in artistic works. That's why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "Any thought and any revolution that is not shaped in the form of art will not survive." The revolutions of the 20th century had no ideal society of their own in history, and they were ultimately and mainly dependent on the beliefs and ideals which were affiliated to society. The Islamic Revolution, however, had focused on its past Islamic identity and tried to revive those ideals according to the requirements of the modern time. During the heat of the Islamic Revolution, a number of students of the faculties of art joined the ranks of people and founded the basis of a current which became known as Islamic Revolutionary Art. Later on, they held exhibitions in Tehran and other cities. With the start of the imposed eight-year war in 1980s, artists reacted to this great event in pursuit of two goals. Firstly, they tried to persuade people to join the war fronts and sympathize with the combatants. Secondly, artists wanted to symbolically demonstrate the highly lofty values and beliefs like martyrdom, which was manifested beautifully by the youth in battle fronts. Therefore, most of the artists would attend the fronts to directly narrate the unique scenes of valor and self-sacrifice of the combatants. In view of this, the walls of cities were painted with the pictures of martyrs who had heroically sacrificed their souls to safeguard the country and Islam. Comparison of the arts during the first years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution shows that, in many cases, the elements and motifs of the ancient Iranian art are present in the artistic works of this era. The Iranian artist now looks at the Western art with more precision. He tries to reconstruct and update his ancient heritage with modern methods and moderate the teachings of the new art according to the ancient genuine values. A unique feature of the Islamic Revolution's art is endurance and continuity. Who is it so? Ayatollah Khamenei believes that the reason is the fact that the revolution speaks of truth, and truth stays firmly and strongly. The art of the Islamic Revolution, too, has continued and flourished as it speaks and depicts truth. The last but not the least, The Islamic Revolution has made artists committed to moral and human values. The Iranian artist has realized his responsibility before mankind and has become depictor and illustrator of justice, love, self-sacrifice, martyrdom, and all human values.
Epic, glory, honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy. See the world through IRIB English Radio, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The European Union Agency for Asylum, EUAA, says new refugee applications in the 27-country bloc are at a five-year high, mainly being submitted by Afghans and Syrians. On Wednesday, 19 refugees were found dead on the border between Turkey and EU nation Greece. It's believed they died from hypothermia. The European Commission claims it's trying to gather further information. EU Home Affairs ministers have been meeting to try and advance the bloc's new refugee policy, known as the Migration Pact.
The strategy of all or nothing up to now has actually given us nothing, and this is not good for member states or the European Union. We want to breathe new life into the EU Migration Pact.
When it comes to the refugee crisis, civil society organizations and many EU lawmakers make the point that the West never learns from its mistakes. They are expressing concern that stoking tensions with Russia over Ukraine has the potential to create a new refugee crisis. It's suggested war hawks in the US and NATO don't give a damn about the millions of people who have been displaced through military intervention in countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Libya. As the EU's Poland and Lithuania construct a new wall along their borders with Belarus, the European Commission is promising billions of euro to expand and arm the bloc's border agency, Frontex.
Frontex is by far the biggest agency we ever had. And we are setting it up right now, and it's huge. It's going to have 10,000 armed people at our external borders.
The EU's own data shows 100,000 children and teenagers go missing in the bloc every year. Most of those are refugees. Campaigners are calling for greater cooperation between police forces.
There need to be better information sharing platforms so we know exactly how many children are going missing and what are the actual risks that they face, because right now, nobody knows.
With EU nations refusing to take in refugees, and as billions are spent on keeping them out, rights groups are again asking, where are the bloc's much-trumpeted values? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In
In overcrowded dinghies and often in the cover of darkness, migrants, among them people running away from wars and instability, take to the choppy waters separating France from the UK. Some make it, others die trying. 27 of them in November last year alone. An incident that further strained the fragile ties between Paris and London. French President Emmanuel Macron says Britain's reliance on illegal immigrant labor is behind the surge in numbers crossing from France and in their deaths.
I think it's definitely political because he's getting set to run his election campaign. You know, we've had Brexit as well, so we know that that has impacted. But the reality is we're talking about human beings. So this is not about political point scoring, or it shouldn't be about political point scoring between governments.
Britain says the French president is absolutely wrong, that the government here is searching for ways to stop the crossings. This is what Interior Minister Priti Patel had to say in the wake of those tragic deaths in November.
We're not working just to end these crossings because we don't care or we're heartless. There's no quick fix. This is about addressing long-term pull factors, smashing criminal gangs that treat human beings as cargo, and tackling supply chains.
To do that, Britain wants France to let British police patrol French beaches. It has ruled out physically pushing boats back across the English Channel. It wants to give people traffickers life sentences and has introduced a controversial bill that will allow it to send migrants to detention centers in other countries. To campaigners, that is draconian and racist.
The Nationality and Borders Bill seeks to make it even more difficult for people to seek asylum in Britain, which again is a contravening international human rights laws. It will also mean that there's a higher scrutiny of people. There are tighter deadlines as it stands.
More than 28,000 migrants crossed the English Channel in 2021, triple the number the year before.
And while British and French leaders continue to trade accusations, more desperate migrants will embark on that perilous journey across the English Channel, and that will almost certainly mean more deaths. Saeed Puriza, London.
It is the revolution that continues to reverberate around the globe. Iran's Islamic Revolution ushering in a new age by ousting the US-backed Pahlavi regime. Father Frank Gehli, who became an ordained minister, recalls his initial reaction when news of the revolution broke.
At the time, I considered myself quite left-wing, so I enjoyed the idea there should be a revolution against the Shah, because I considered the Shah a tyrant.
One of the most inspirational things about the Islamic Revolution for its many admirers is not just the impact that it's had inside of Iran, but it's the growing legacy that it continues to build globally. For political observers, Iran's stoic path proved an innovative and bold new model where alliances could be forged and solidarity fostered.
Because of its anti-imperialistic values, that's why Iran has good relations with lots of other countries around the world, Muslim and non-Muslim, that have also suffered colonialism and occupation. I mean, it could be Cuba, it could be Venezuela, many countries in Africa around the world who, you know, have a certain affinity with Iran because of that.
There's also another element to those who admire the aims and accomplishments of the revolution.
The Iranian revolution, as I mentioned, it tells us how you don't have to have only one model of political system. Whereby, I mean, here in this country, we have a monarch who is head of a national church, but it's a farce. In reality, God has been pushed out of a public sphere, and so the whole thing is a charade. In Iran, there is a valuable presence of faith in the public sphere.
As the revolution moves towards another remarkable milestone, the West still continues its opposition campaign despite a lack of success.
I can't think of too many examples of countries around the world that have withstood the barrage of war, sanctions, media hatred, internal subterfuge, you know, kind of instigated from outside, that Iran has. yet they're still here. And they're not just surviving by the skin of their teeth. They're thriving as well. They have a strong military. They have strong regional allies. They have political influence, especially within their area in the Middle East. I think that it's widely recognized